Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
She's already been dubbed the Doomsday Mom, convicted in Idaho for the horrific murders of her children. But Lori Vallow Daybell isn't done with the courtroom spotlight just yet. Now she's heading to a brand new murder conspiracy trial in Arizona for the death of her fourth husband, Charles Vallow. And in a move that feels more like an episode of Law & Order Narcissism Unit, she's decided to represent herself. Seriously. Today we're breaking down what this trial might look like and what prosecutors are bringing to the table and how Lori's decision to go full DIY defense could either be a train wreck or a twisted masterstroke. Joining us is former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis. Eric, when you have a defendant facing first-degree murder charges, choosing to represent themselves, is this ever a smart legal move, or is it just courtroom cosplay kind of going a little bit too far?
Yeah, Tony, in my experience, it is wholly perilous for an individual to go and represent themselves, especially for the most serious crime there is. It's the highest stakes there are. It's an extremely serious matter, extremely complicated case to handle and defend. And I was rather shocked when I learned that she was, in fact, going to go forward and represent herself. But here we are.
Why did she choose to represent herself? I mean, we know like the Sarah Boone case, the suitcase murderer, she chose because, well, it was really hard to find anybody to represent her until she finally kind of did get somebody. But with this case, why? I mean, she could have had a public defender. It's hard to understand Lori's reasoning, but why?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, she's not really a creature of reason. And so not sure what her thought process was. Sometimes when folks choose to represent themselves, it is because they want control, that they want to be at the helm. They want to be making decisions. And when you have an attorney who's saying, hey, no, you shouldn't do that, mm-hmm. and a really headstrong client who wants to do it anyway, the solution in the client's mind is sometimes being their own lawyer.
Wow. Have you ever seen a case where this works out well, where the defendant decides to do this? Maybe someone of a little bit sounder mind than Lori, that just, you know, they got it down. Maybe they have a little legal experience. Maybe they watched a lot of Judge Judy and they thought they could handle it. I mean, what have you ever seen it happen?
There was one case that I covered for Court TV. The gentleman's name escapes me. There was like a drug issue involved and someone got killed. But this guy was really on top of things. He had a reasonably good grasp of the evidence. He was able to respond to objections. He was coherent and cogent. And those are just not characteristics I've really seen Lori Vallow Daybell exhibit yet.
From what we've seen in the pretrial hearings and motions and all that, this already certainly looks to be a train wreck. I guess how, why? I mean, is this going to work? Is this trial going to get to a completion? Because the way she talks right now, and I'm not going to play a gazillion clips because we've already done it, it's word salad. I mean, she doesn't seem to even understand what she's talking about at all. It's just randomness. It's words that don't make sense in context. It's a lot of just generalities that have nothing to do with anything. And that judge, my God, he has patience. But are we going to see this come to completion, or at some point are they just going to have to say something like, look, this isn't working. I don't know. Can they at some point say, look, this is not going to work?
Cases involving pro se defendants have a higher likelihood, in my opinion, of resulting in a mistrial because the defendant doesn't know the rules, doesn't know what they can and can't talk about, doesn't know courtroom decorum and how to observe all of the strictures that are associated with a high-profile murder trial. And so, you know, could Lori Vallow Daybell kind of step in it and do something eccentric and bizarre and totally out of line with typical courtroom conduct that results in things being so patently unfair that they have to require a mistrial? That's at least a possibility here. You know, she was found, or there were some questions as to her competency before, but I guess the judge is satisfied that she's got enough up there to go forward right now.
If you could predict, like, what, you know, in terms of decorum, in terms of courtroom procedure, obviously she has no clue what she's doing. I think she'd have difficulty ordering something at Starbucks, more or less, representing herself in court. What are the top three ways you could see her destroying this, where the jury ends up hearing something and they have to declare a mistrial? What are the three most likely ways that could occur in this case?
You know, I've seen it before, at least come close to a mistrial with like interruptions and outbursts and just speaking out of turn, talking about things that have zero relevance to the case. So the jury is only supposed to hear information and evidence that pertains to the charges alleged. But if Lori starts talking about, you know, being some deity and otherworldly dimensions and what have you, could that be make things go so far afield, so far off track that the judge says, hey, this is no longer resembling a reasonable trial and we have to order a mistrial? It could happen.
If they order a mistrial, what do we do? I mean, obviously there would be another trial, I would think. You can't require someone, I guess, to have an attorney. I mean, could this be a really weird loophole where this indefinitely goes on until she's dead, basically, where it's like, no, I'm going to keep representing myself every time. And every time I do it, it ends up being a mistrial because she gets so out of control. I mean, at some point, do they just say she's not competent because she keeps destroying every trial that they put together for her? I mean, this is a costly thing to do over and over and over with a crazy person.
Exactly right. And, you know, the judge has a duty to, even though the defendant has been found competent before, if there is overwhelming evidence of a lack of legal competency in the trial, the judge would probably have a duty to step in and say, hey, wait a sec. I just don't feel like she can adequately represent herself in this. We got to order a mistrial. And so we go back to the drawing board and it becomes this perpetual cycle. Now, at that point, the judge could try to put in place additional protective measures like advisory counsel or multiple advisory counsel attorneys who would try and steer this thing at least to some viable conclusion.
What do we expect the prosecution to bring to the table in this, and how easy of a task is that going to be? I mean, is this the definition? And there's truly never a definition, but if there ever was a definition of a slam dunk case, is this that? And what do you expect them to bring against Lori? Is it going to be a long, ongoing, here's a ton of evidence against Lori, or is it just like, here's a couple facts, jurors, have a good day?
You know, I think the prosecution would be wise to kind of streamline things because they've got to be mindful of the jury's time and attention. And I'm telling you, this thing is going to get bogged down multiple times due to Lori Vallaudeville representing herself. And so they don't, the prosecution doesn't want to drag this out, put on unnecessary evidence. I think that they should identify their most cogent and compelling witnesses and items of evidence and really hang their hat on those and try to avoid any sort of eccentricities and bizarre behavior that could possibly shut down this trial midway through.
What kind of risks are being taken here when Lori tries to cross-examine witnesses? I mean, we're talking people that will be on the stand talking directly to the woman who has allegedly killed their loved ones. I mean, we're talking, you know, Kay Woodcock, Charles' sister, many other people who, you know, were involved in this at a very intimate level that normally, you know, you'd be crossed by their attorney, but it's her herself. Does that, I mean, hopefully everyone can kind of keep their wits about them, but when you have Lori crossing you and saying utterly ridiculous things, that could be a little bit triggering, I would think, to some of those witnesses. And I wonder what kind of issues that could bring to this case.
Yes, certainly. So, you know, even seasoned defense counsel has to approach cross-examination of victims' families and victims' friends extremely delicately, because you do not want to create a bad impression with the jury that you're, you know, going after the victim's family or trying to make them look bad or trying to upset them, that kind of thing. And those are all risks that Lori runs with just kind of how she has presented so far and how she might handle those cross-examinations. And so she could really shoot herself in the foot in making errors and missteps when dealing with these extremely sensitive and delicate matters concerning victims, families, and friends.
Is there any chance, I have not seen the witness list, and I think it would probably be news if he was on there, but is there any chance that we could see an appearance by Chad Daybell in this case at all? I mean, I know they're spouses and there's rules for that, but again, we have one convicted of another crime that does somewhat relate to this. Is there any way that would happen or any way that anyone would want that to happen, either from the defense or the prosecution?
You know, Tony, Chad does have some ancillary involvement in this case regarding the killing of prior husband Charles Bellew, because there's an allegation that Lori was cheating on Charles with Chad. So he's involved, and folks who are involved are subject to being called as witnesses. Now, I think that could turn things into such a circus that the prosecution might be weary of doing that. They might say, hey, look, I have enough evidence. I'm not going to play into any sort of bizarre antics, and I'm not going to call Chad. But on the other hand, they could, because Chad has engaged in criminality with Lori. They are sort of in league together, and it's a possibility and certainly one that has some fireworks to it.
It does, and it makes you wonder, like, is it worth playing that hand? It's like you already have, like, a royal flush. It's like, do we bring Chad in just for the show? I mean, obviously, that's not a legal tactic. Nobody's going to want to do things just for the show. You want to win. Yeah, I mean, does it create more potential issues than it would anything positive or trying to meet the goal of convicting her on this if you're the prosecution?
The prosecution has to be careful about admitting what are called extrinsic acts. So information and evidence that, although it might have some relationship to the case, it wasn't, you know, Chad, there's no allegation that Chad killed Charles, for example. Mm-hmm. And so if you start getting too far afield and the witnesses have too attenuated a connection to the trial, and on top of that, it's very inflammatory, Chad's involvement in his conviction for killing he and Lori's children, then you start to risk, hey, does this turn into such a show and such a debacle that an appellate court would say, hey, that was too prejudicial to call him. You didn't need to do it. You took that risk and we're going to reverse the conviction. That's always a possibility on appeal.
Obviously, you know, we can look at this and it's very easy to go, this is a crazy circus. She's obviously done horrible, horrible things. But at the end of the day, this is a conspiracy case to commit murder. obviously through her dead brother, Alex Cox, who is obviously not here anymore. What evidence do we have? What do we know that's out there that directly links Lori to Alex and motivating him or telling him or instructing him to kill her ex-husband? I mean, is there a lot? I mean, on the surface, you can look and go, well, obviously this is part of it, but what do we have? I mean, it seems like it could be a slam dunk, but is it really?
You know, for conspiracy, you need evidence of an agreement between two people to commit a crime. My understanding is that there are alleged text messages between Alex and Lori talking about missions and mm-hmm. talking about removing obstacles to this, you know, to Lori ushering in the apocalypse, and that was veiled language for killing Charles Vello. On top of that, you know, Lori did have a motive. There was an insurance policy that the prosecution is saying Lori wanted to avail herself of. And so those things together. Also, Lori said that Charles would die soon and wasn't too disturbed after he died. I guess she had a pool party shortly thereafter. So there is significant evidence, but not a slam dunk.
Pool party after. Oh, God. Yeah.
Weird party.
Makes me think of Corey Richens and the party at that house right after her husband dies, too. People are interesting. So you also have to prove, don't you, that Lori, through these texts, through these missions, through these all the religious fervor language that they used, that she believed that this had something to do with murder. That might be a stronger hill or a taller hill to climb than we think, because I don't know that, you know, she's contemplating murder as murder in the context of reality. Could she argue that she believed that it was not murder, that they were talking about this mission and Alex took it upon himself to construe these words is to murder someone, and it wasn't her who sang it. It was just, no, you know, buy him a ticket to Panama, or just like it's something else other than murder because of the language that she uses and her bizarre belief systems that don't jive with reality.
You hit the nail on the head. I think there are potentially viable defenses here in terms of, you know, what does this coded, veiled religious language mean? And you know, the prosecution has to prove that Lori had an intent to kill Charles Vello. And on top of that, you know, Alex Cox is deceased. He's the other co-conspirator. And so it'd be pretty darn easy for a skilled attorney to argue that, hey, this was all Alex is doing. In fact, he pulled the trigger. Lori never wanted to kill this guy. She's a little eccentric, but that doesn't make her a murderer. Can Lori pull off such an argument to a jury? That's a different question.
Another interesting angle to this, and I'm wondering if it would be different if the tables were turned, if Charles was the crazy one and Lori was the sane one, because Charles talked to police multiple times, told them so many things about how she's not mentally well, how she has these bizarre beliefs, how she's, you know, threatening to kill people and him and all this stuff. And it really, I don't want to say it fell on deaf ears, but I mean, I don't know that they had a whole lot of recourse of what they could do. Was there anything in this part of the case? I have a lot of issues with the other part of the case and police response initially, that they could have done to prevent this, or legally were the authorities' hands tied based on what was known and based on what she had done up to that point that we knew of when he's out there saying, she's saying she wants to kill me, basically.
Yeah, definitely some scary stuff alleged before Charles Vello actually perished. And like you said, he indicated that he thinks Lori wanted to harm him and also that Lori wanted to harm the children. Mm-hmm. And this is before the children had been killed.
Yeah.
And so, gosh, it'd be great if there was some sort of law enforcement intervention that could have taken place. But, you know, do these allegations rise to the level of a crime. In order to prove something like or arrest somebody for making threats, usually there has to be what are called actual threats. There has to be a bona fide, genuine, supported belief that a person might follow through on these threats. And I think police at the time concluded that there wasn't enough there to bring some sort of arrest based on just threats that Charles Vallow is telling us occurred.
Is it, again, but if it was the other way around, and this is just conjecture, if she's going to police saying my husband is threatening to kill me, this and that, in most cases, I would think Charles would be locked up fairly quickly, because it's the other way around. Was it looked at differently? Just because, you know, she was female, he was male, and that seems to be how that tends to work. Not saying right or wrong. I'm saying it's wrong. It is wrong because it's a double standard, and the risk is just as intense either way. But is that an issue here where, I mean, obviously it's not something that's going to be coming up in this trial, but I think something that really should be criticized in this whole case is the police handling of the information they got at the time. She could really play it off well. We've seen the videos, the body cam footage of, oh no, it's just this or that. And she did present herself in a very positive light. It's just a misunderstanding. And he could have done the same too, but would it have worked out the same way?
You know, it's a totally fair question. The promise is equal justice under the law, mm-hmm. but is that always how it plays out? It's just not.
No.
You know, the police are going to look at relationship dynamics. They're going to look at the characteristics of the parties involved. And perhaps they look at this and say, hey, you know, this husband, he's kind of a formidable dude. He's not like a small shrimp or something.
No.
And, you know, if he says, hey, his little, you know, blonde wife is threatening him, is that going to be viewed the same as if Lori said, hey, my, you know, Charles Vallow, who's pretty significant, mm-hmm. dude, is threatening her? I'm not sure it would be viewed the same. And right or wrong, the police did not intervene. And now here we are multiple deaths later.
And that was the big issue. When I first heard of this story several years ago, I think it was Dateline. That was the first thing that stood out to me, was how long it took for police to intervene and arrest them, or at least question them, when the children were missing. And I know this is not about the kids in this trial, but it all kind of comes together. How long can your kids be missing and you don't have to prove that they exist before they step in and go, we're going to take you into custody. Produce your kids, never producing the kids, like months. Like, that seemed to be a bit extreme. Was this just something, when we look back on it retrospectively, that just kind of slipped through the cracks, as so many cases do? I mean, we look at the foster care system, we look at all of that, and there's many times where these kids just slip through the cracks. Is this just another one of those that ended up getting such a larger spotlight on it because of how heinous the crime was?
You know, whenever there is a child who's alleged to be in harm's way, you always want prompt governmental intervention under those circumstances. Usually what that might look like is social services, mm-hmm. coming out, paying visits to the parents, and collecting evidence, collecting information. You know, if the parents say something that they can't back up, well, that is suspicious. If they say something that's demonstrably false, that's even more suspicious. It's easy to say in hindsight that other things should have been done, of course, but the hope is that there is valid governmental intervention that protects children and ultimately prevents this kind of thing from happening. And there have been cases where social services intervened and the children get out of a really mm-hmm. dangerous situation. That's not what happened here.
Well, and they just took her at her word. They're over there. Okay, ma'am. You know, I mean, there really wasn't a whole lot of proof that she had to make. I mean, you had the Woodcocks calling and saying, hey, my grandkids are missing. I don't think this is right, over and over and over. And okay, well, let us go look into it. Oh, she says that they're fine. Case closed. That seems to be how this went. And again, on the this case with Charles Vallow, it was self-defense. Took him at his word. Were you surprised that there wasn't any sort of investigation into this, especially with the fact that there was body cam video of Charles saying to police, she's going to try to kill me, and then he ends up dead?
One of the first things as a former prosecutor that I would look at if there was a domestic violence related murder allegation is I pull all of the police history in terms of contacts with their property. Have the police ever had to go out to the home before? Have there been prior reported disturbances? Has anyone reported a threat, which Charles Vallo did report? You know, you look into those things because on the scene, you know, when you have a dead guy and the person who shot him and the person who shot him says, hey, this was self-defense. Well, the dead guy can't speak for himself. And so the prosecutor and law enforcement needs to look into the history of that relationship and see if it is in line with or negates what the shooter on scene is saying. And here there would have been some real questions had that full history been procured.
I would question, you know, anything in this jurisdiction, you know, because this is not obviously the only case where you have domestic concerns of one being scared for their life of their partner. And if this is how they handled this one, how are other ones being handled? And I'm not saying that the police, you know, need to be charged or anything like that. I mean, that's nearly impossible to begin with. But seriously, take a look at these policies and how these things have been handled, because obviously a lot of people ended up dead where I feel like there was a lot of opportunity to intervene and stop this mad woman and her crazy husband from going down the road that they did.
Domestic violence situations have a heightened likelihood of lethality. Unfortunately, those just result in murders more often than, you know, a bar fight or two friends or two guys who don't like each other or something. And so you've got to approach those very sensitively. In fact, in Colorado, where I practice, there's a list of lethality factors that we look at and we say, hey, what are the chances that if we don't do something firm here, this is going to escalate to a death? And some of those factors appear to have been present in the prior disturbance between Charles Vallo and Lori Vallo Daybell, including threats to kill somebody and also just sort of a detachment from reality. It's unclear to me how closely those things were looked at.
One more thing on the trial that's coming up. And there's a lot of talk of her taking the stand, possibly with herself being her own attorney. How does that work?
Painfully. It's going to be something where Lori Vallo gets up. Some judges require the pro se person to like ask themselves a question, then answer it. I don't think this judge is going to think that she can do that. So the judge is probably going to allow her to kind of testify in a narrative fashion. We're probably going to hear about just wild otherworldly stuff, deities and dimensions and an upcoming apocalypse. And how is the jury going to view that when she's on trial for murder?
Do you cross her at that point? Just let her, after she's done everything and said all that, do you just like, yeah, you got anything in prosecution? No, I'm good. Or do you? Do you dig into that? Do you double down and go, let's hear more?
Yeah, if it were me, I'd probably double down, in part because she's so inclined to vocalize everything she's feeling, and she's so resolute in what she believes to be her reality, that I, you know, she sort of set herself up, and then as cross-examination, I would let her keep doing it, and I would just let her go. And the jury over time might conclude, hey, this person is a problem, and they are capable of murder, and this is a murder trial.
It's going to be fascinating, without a doubt. Do you think we get to a conclusion and a verdict, or do you predict this is going to end up collapsing on itself in some way, shape, or form?
The judge has a Herculean effort to ensure that this case proceeds as properly as possible, and that there is some kind of finality, there is some verdict, and I trust that the judge has thought about this and has measures in place towards that end. And I think it's likely we will get a verdict. And I don't think Lori Vallo Daybell's going anywhere anytime soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.